You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there are heated oral arguments and cases regarding LGBT workers and workplace discrimination at the U.S. Supreme Court this week. We'll look at that issue and other big-ticket items in the new session of the court. First, if you think about your local mall, there's a handful of stores that are usually fixtures. One of those in recent years has been Forever 21, a fast fashion store originally marketed to young women that filed for bankruptcy last month. The company released a list of 178 locations in the U.S. they say may close, depending on things like whether they can renegotiate rent agreements with landlords. That list includes two stores in Wisconsin at Mayfair Mall in Wauwatosa and Westtown Mall in Madison. The bankruptcy may have surprised some fans of the store, but to industry watchers, it was another sign of big, almost constant change in the retail industry. Hart Posen is an associate professor of management and human resources at UW-Madison's School of Business. Hart, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, a fast rise for Forever 21. Was this bankruptcy a surprise?
Well, the rise wasn't that. They started in the early 80s, right? They're at the forefront of fast fashion and really the first major player in the U.S. market doing that. Does it come as a surprise? I don't think it comes as a surprise. I think over the last couple of years, we've seen attention to Forever 21 sort of diminishing and them being slightly displaced at the frontier.
Fast fashion, it was a new term to me not that long ago. I guess I wasn't on top of the trend. What do we mean by that?
What we mean is clothing retailers that are trying initially to mimic what was on the runway in Milan and New York and try to get it into the stores really quickly with selections that changed all the time, but also at super low prices.
And that was a concern for some people, and it seems like more people are concerned lately about sustainability, labor issues, things like that. I don't know if that's something that's going to drive a business into bankruptcy, but it is something people are talking about.
I think people are indeed talking about that, although I think that wouldn't be a key driver here in what's happening to Forever 21.
Yeah, what are the key drivers? What led to this bankruptcy?
You know, they expanded really rapidly. And until fairly recently, they had a ton of expansion plans still. And they're now in over 40 countries and hundreds of stores in the U.S. And what happens is they got bigger. Not only did they get bigger in the number of stores, they made their stores bigger and bigger and bigger. They almost wanted to be the department store of fast fashion. And as they did that, it gets harder and harder to be fast. It gets harder and harder to be on trend. And as you have these huge stores with tons of items, inevitably most of them are not that fast.
Now, we asked our listeners where they shop for clothes and if they had thoughts on Forever 21. Ashley writes, I used to love Forever 21. If they still sold the same styles they had when I was 21, I'd still be shopping there. Ditto H&M and others. Ashley writes, sorry, once all the pants went ultra skinny, all the shirts are made out of some sort of napkin material but cost as much as real clothes, I'm not into it. So, like, something is changing maybe in consumer taste, or did something change in what they were offering consumers?
You know, I it's unclear how much has changed in consumer taste with regard to the quality, for instance. You know, there has been the rise of a bunch of online retailers, online-only fast fashion retailers, Boohoo, ASOS, a few others, that are squarely in this space. I think more than sort of a desire among 17-year-olds for long-lasting clothes, because I just don't buy that. They don't want to wear them that long. is this idea that the notion of what makes something trendy has changed? It used to be the runway in New York or Milan. Now it's YouTube influencers. Instagram influencers, etc., and the new players, the new online only players, have grown up in the era of social media as defining trends, where Forever 21 and to some extent H&M and Zara grew up in the era of the catwalk defining trends.
Talking to Hart Posen from UW-Madison School of Business, we're looking at retail clothing, and the bankruptcy of Forever 21. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Simple question for you, where do you buy your clothing? Or do you make your own? 800-642-1234. We were talking before we got started, Hart. We often call you when bad news happens for a business. But because bad news is happening for one business doesn't mean it's happening for everybody in retail. Are there stores, not online, but actual stores that are selling clothes that are going like gangbusters these days.
Well, I think, you know, we continue to see TJ Maxx and their variety of brands that's Marshalls, that is now the Sierra Trading Post, which is now Sierra. They have a store that just opened up in Madison. We continue to see them doing very well. And, you know, you wanted me to exclude the online players, but there, you know, there is lots of innovation and creativity in fashion. And though there will continue to be lots of winners, including winners in the mall.
Yeah, let's talk about the mall. Here's a comment from Darlene on Facebook who says, mall chain stores sell clothing that's basically overly priced wrapping paper. I want to focus on the mall part of that. And we hear about the decline of the mall and some malls not doing well, but you say that's not across the board?
Look, I think, you know, there's some recent data from an association of U.S. shopping mall owners. There are lots of young, even young people, you know, Forever 21's demographic, who still want to go to the mall. They still want to try it on. They still want it to be highly social with their friends, sharing in the change rooms together, looking at each other, talking to each other, while still sharing pictures on Instagram, right? And so I don't think that the social element will go away. I think what's happening, and you see it in lots of malls now, is mall owners and the stores in them are finding ways to make use of that, to leverage the socialness of it. Now it's happening slowly. And for many of the big clothing retail chains, which were massive, right, with stores in every mall in the country, it's been hard. But things are moving.
Is there a thing where just store chains get too big and they're not nimble enough to keep up with that kind of change in the market? Or do you have an example of somebody who really navigated an abrupt change in consumer attitudes and tastes?
Well, you know, I think it is broadly true that the bigger you get, the harder it is to change. Not simply because, you know, if you think of a store like Forever 21, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of items in that store. Imagine your fast fashion. Some of these online fashion retailers are adding like 300 styles a day to their lineup.
Wow.
And they only stay there for a few days or a few weeks. The bigger you get, the more stuff you have, the more of that you have to do. And that gets really hard, really complicated, really fast.
Talking to Hart Posen from UW-Madison School of Business. He's with us to talk about changes in the retail industry after the fast fashion retailer Forever 21 filed for bankruptcy last month. When you want to talk about fashion, you're going to talk to Rob Ferret and Hart Posen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you buy your clothes these days? Do you have an actual physical shop you like to visit? Do you get your clothes online? How about resale? And would you be sad to see fast fashion stores like Forever 21 go away, or good riddance? If you used to shop at Forever 21 but don't anymore, call in and tell us why. Our number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we pick up our conversation about fast fashion store Forever 21 filing for bankruptcy and how that fits in with bigger trends in retail. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you buy clothes? How have your shopping habits changed, if at all, in recent years? Do you go to physical stores, or do you like to order them online, new or used? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Deborah is with us in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hello. I have to give two thumbs up to Goodwill. I get clothing from exclusive designers and stores that I could never afford to purchase. I'm looking at right now, it's a 100% silk shirt from Sutton Studio, and it's my newest clothing item, and it was like $2.50 at Goodwill.
$2.50.
$2.50.
Deborah, thank you so much for sharing that. And we heard from Amber on the Ideas Network Facebook page who says, thrift stores are my first stop. Thrift stores have always been with us, Hart. Is there a trend going on here, though, lately?
Well, I think we can, you know, thrift stores have been around forever.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a trend amongst kids. My daughter talks about going to the thrift store to buy clothes. She's 15. I do think there's also more stuff going on at the high end. There are online retailers that sell high-end fashion, deeply discounted, high-end fashion. So I think that's here to stay. It may even grow, but like everything, you know, that nothing is forever.
Not even 21.
Not even 21.
Though they may stay around, I should say.
Yeah, they are. They're restructuring. They're not gone. They're not gone yet. Mm-hmm. But
thanks for that call, Deborah. Let's go now to Colin with us in Milwaukee. Colin, hi.
Hi. I was just calling to say I'm a 27-year-old millennial, I guess you could say, and both myself and most of my friends really enjoy Kohl's. Like, it's the first place we'll go. And I think one of the big reasons is their online website is great, but then it's also really easy to go in their store and quickly try on a whole different pile of clothes. And if they don't have the exact size you're looking for, you can then just get it shipped right to your house for free usually. And I don't know why, but for whatever reason, they just seem to be really popular with people my age.
Colin, thanks for the call. So Kohl's and the younger millennials.
Yeah, Kohl's, Target, and others, you know, they've been really focusing strongly on this. I think it goes against the popular logic that brick-and-mortar retailers are going away. I don't think they are. It is the very good ones are searching for a way that captures the best of online and the best of in-store. And it's taken us quite a while to get there, but I think Kohl's in particular is a very good example of a firm that's doing remarkably well in that space. I think Target, to some extent, is doing well in that space, and others are trying.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dan joins us now in Platteville. Dan, hello.
Yes, I usually do most of my shopping either at like Walmart or sometimes actually Cabela's or Bass Pro Shop, which is a they're actually outdoor stores, but they actually have clothes that look nice but fit me. A big issue I have when I go to most of the stores like in the mall. Most of their clothes, they're like, say if I buy a pair of pants, they go up to like maybe size 36, if that. Shirts that maybe I'll be lucky if I find one for extra large. And when I say, hey, I have nothing here that fits me, they just simply just someplace they apologize and just say, oh, sorry, we don't have anything that fits larger people.
Dan, thanks for that. Thanks for that call, and I've heard similar things about stores like Forever 21, too, that they cater more toward smaller sizes. Is this something, is this intentional in stores? They want to be seen as a store for a certain size, Hart?
Well, you know, I think there's been some pushback against being, well, we have to distinguish between the stores for teens and
the stores for our caller there. Yeah.
Middle-aged people like me and you. Mm-hmm. Not that you're middle-aged.
Well, no, that's fair.
Wow. But, you know, even at the... Yeah, even at the teen,
I'll
even
just weep at, here.
That's okay. I'll catch your tears. Even at the teen end, there has been push away from that extra skinny kind of thing. You know, actually, Forever 21 got in trouble this past year for including Diet Atkins lemon bars in their packages delivered from online orders, and there was a big media blow up about that because it suggested something about what is an appropriate weight. So I think there is greater sensitivity of that at the lower end, but there's also movement in this caller's, you know, talking about Cabela's and what have you. Mm-hmm. Remember, I said that TJ Maxx is spreading a new chain that used to be only online called Sierra Trading Post, which is sporting goods online discount retailer in the TJ Maxx sort of way. And they're now opening up stores across the country, including a new one in Madison just a few weeks ago. So I think that's relaxing somewhat, although the mall, you know, may change much more slowly.
And we're talking about clothes for younger women versus older men in this case.
Middle-aged men.
Middle-aged men, sure. Is this a demographic people are really excited about in the industry? It seems like they're really trying to sell clothes to young people or to old people who want to be young people.
I think we can, you know, mall retailers for a long time now have been focused on youth. I suspect there'll be some rebalancing there over time. And I think part of sort of seeing some of the youth-focused retailers go away and change the distribution of online and in-store will open up spaces for a broader array of demographics in those mall spaces.
All right, let's go to another caller. Jean is with us now in Milwaukee. Jean, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share my thoughts on Forever 21 and the reason why myself and my female friends and sisters have stopped frequenting the stores. When it first opened, and it was really popular, the stores were smaller with fewer items. And I recall the quality of the items being slightly better the way than it is now. It was still affordable, but it's too much stuff at a higher price, and it was just not a really good payoff. And I'm not really surprised where it is now.
And Jean, can I ask, where do you and your crew go shopping now?
Unfortunately, I hate to say this, we all shop online now. Whenever we talk about clothes, whenever we talk about fashion, we're always showing each other our items on our mobile phones. And we're just shopping online now.
Jean, thanks for the call. Jean and her friends are the only people in the country with that story to tell, Hart. True or false?
Obviously false. You know, look, I think, as I said at the outset, that they added lots of stores, and the stores got huge, right? These became super big stores. And I think it was increasingly hard for them to keep track of trends and keep up with trends. On the quality front, whether it's decreased marginally or not, I don't think I can speak to. I do think, you know, this caller talking about, you know, the social part is no longer standing and looking at the item together, but looking at our phones together. I do think that some retailers are trying to add back the social part so that we will want to go with our friends as non-16-year-olds and engage in those kinds of social interactions. They have to if it's going to work for them.
Gene, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Hart Posen from UW-Madison School of Business, looking at changes in retail clothing with Forever 21 filing for bankruptcy, probably closing a bunch of stores. Hart, before we go back to our callers, if fast fashion stores like Forever 21 are in trouble, does that mean fast fashion is in trouble?
No, I don't think so. I think exactly the opposite. Forever 21 is in trouble in part because ultimately, given their girth in some sense, they were no longer fast enough. And they weren't fast enough to keep up with the influencers online. And they didn't have the systems and structures in place to do that. So I don't think fast fashion's in trouble at all.
So somebody's going to come along that's just even faster come along.
Folks are. These online players are coming along. They're shipping out of one centralized warehouse, much easier to track inventory. They're killing it.
Let's go to another caller. Jose is with us in Appleton. Jose, hi.
Hello, how are you guys doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Jose?
Yeah, I have an 11-year-old daughter, and her thing is everything she wants, she finds online. And one thing that I have done is just teach her the importance of supporting our brick-and-mortar and smaller retailers, not necessarily the bigger malls. And telling her maybe we won't find exactly what you want at some of these smaller retailers, but just the importance of being able to maintain some of these smaller independent-owned retail shops or clothing shops, may they be resale or new.
Jose, thanks for the call. So is there room out there for those maybe independent local brick-and-mortar stores that Jose's hoping to support?
You know, I think there continues to be some room for them. You know, I think what the bankruptcy at Forever 21, but also Payless, the challenges of many other retailers of this sort, indicates that the gigantic impersonal is as challenged as the small, tiny, and local. You know, it is the sort of the quest to find elements for the large players that can make them more local, more personal, more interactive, more social. At the same time, the small mom and pops, really, if they're going to survive, they have to move in that direction as well.
Now, I read a while back that, okay, you had in the bookstore industry now, Barnes & Noble and Borders driving all your local bookstores out of business. But then Amazon came along, Borders is gone, Barnes & Noble not doing as hot, and that's created new space for the
mom
old independent
pops.
Bookstores.
That's right.
I mean, can we see something like that in something like fashion and in clothing?
I think it's possible. I don't think we are seeing that yet. Mm-hmm. This is, for me, the You've Got Mail story. Right,
right.
From that movie, and all of a sudden the big bad bookstores were no longer the big bad bookstores. We haven't seen that yet.
What are you watching for now in retail clothing? Lots of changes. We've talked in the past about Shopko clothing was part of their deal. You know, the department stores like Sears and JCPenney's not doing so swimmingly lately. What are you watching for next?
You know, the first thing I always look at, and this is usually every time I get a call from you about a bankruptcy, is there something distinctive about this firm? And, you know, many of the retailers that we've talked about going out of business or in bankruptcy and restructuring are firms that you got to the point where you looked at that firm and you said, I see nothing distinctive about it. I see no particular reason to go, nothing unique they offer that I can't get anywhere else. And at the same time, you know, the earlier caller talking about Kohl's or Target doing well in some of these spaces, in some sense, Kohl's and Target were as distinctive as some of these fashion-only firms going out of business. So I look for that right away, and you can't see it. And this, you know, at Forever 21, what is distinctive about Forever 21? And the only thing that distinguishes them at this point is their beautiful history in the 80s and 90s and their inability to be as fast as their new rivals.
Is this bad? Is it sad when we lose companies or they file for bankruptcy?
You know, not for me. Don't get me wrong. I understand people lose their jobs. But we need this churn in the economy. One of the tremendous things about the American economy has always been its ability to reallocate resources from poor performing firms to new and better performing firms. This has allowed for tremendous economic growth, tremendous novelty, tremendous innovation. And in some sense, our bankruptcy system is the envy of the world because it is so effective at doing that. So I think we always have to see the upside in this, the room for new players.
Hart, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
That's Hart Posen, professor from UW-Madison School of Business. He's with us today to talk about Forever 21, the fast fashion chain filing for bankruptcy, and what that tells us about changes in the retail clothing industry. Coming up, we'll take a look at some of the cases the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be sorting out during its new term that just began this week. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, get ready for a Wisconsin weekend. Kate Archer-Kent gets the scoop on great state parks for the fall season, and then Kate and her guests take a tour of the state's lighthouses. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court kicked off its new term this week. Justices plan to hear cases on a number of controversial issues, including abortion, guns, immigration, separation of church and state, and the Electoral College, plus workplace discrimination and sexual orientation. On Tuesday, they heard oral arguments over the meaning of sex when it comes to LGBTQ workers. At issue is whether employers can fire, for example, gay employees based on their sexual orientation or transgender workers due to their gender identity. Ryan Owens is a political science professor and the director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership at UW-Madison. His areas of expertise include the U.S. Supreme Court. Ryan, good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, I just read a list of, you know, basically all the hot-button issues in American
right.
politics. Do we usually see this cluster of that kind of controversial issue hitting the Supreme Court all at once?
Yeah, not typically. I mean, it's usually the case that the court will hear two or three really big cases that everybody can kind of get mobilized on. This one is a little bit different. As you said, we've got this whole cluster of big issues. As everybody knows, this is coming up in an election year, too. So, I mean, this is it's a bit of a tinderbox.
So they're starting to hear arguments now. Do I have this right? Decisions usually come out like the following June-ish? Or does that depend?
Yes and no. So about a third of all the court's opinions come down the last 2 weeks of its term, which is usually in June. And those typically are the real big cases. But two-thirds of those other cases are released throughout the course. Now, they just started the court's term this week on Monday. It'll take some time, of course, to write the opinions and stuff. So we won't see any opinions probably come down from the court for at least another month, maybe 2 months.
Do justices, from what we know, look over their shoulder at a looming big presidential election? Does that weigh on their minds as they're deciding a controversial issue?
Well, it does. I hesitate to say that it systematically does, but we clearly have evidence in the historical record that justices have considered this. So in 1992, when the court was determining whether to hear the Casey decision, right, whether to take that up, the liberal justices pushed very hard for the court to release its opinion before that election because they thought that the court was going to whittle back on abortion, and they wanted people to be able to vote on that issue. Chief Justice Rehnquist originally, I think, wanted to slow play that a little bit, and the liberal justices forced his hand on it. Ultimately, the court didn't rule in the way that people thought it would in the case, but it is an indication that, yes, they are paying attention to what's going on politically, and at times they will force an issue if it's big enough.
And before we get into some of the particular cases they're hearing, I've seen some analysis about the role of precedent and how willing at least some of the judges would be to overturn precedent, especially of past Supreme Court rulings. So they're looking at their reading of the law, of course, but looking at the weight of what has come before them in the Supreme Court. How willing are justices to steer the craft in a different way, even if there's no new really developments in that?
Yeah. Well, I guess I'd say two things on it. One is, we really should want justices to adhere to precedent as often as they can. The notion of stability in the law is really crucial. We need to have that. So I think that's the first thing. Like our goal is to try to have stability in the law. Now, having said that, there are, of course, clearly instances where justices should go back or at least rethink existing precedent. Now, in that vein, you know, it always depends on whose ox is getting gored. The biggest proponents of precedent are those who have won victories in the past and they want to keep it there. So it shouldn't surprise any of us that last term we heard a lot about precedent from Kagan, Sotomayor, and Breyer, right? Because they want to protect the existing precedents in areas like abortion. And conversely, you know, the conservative justices will weigh heavily, when they're thinking about precedents that maybe they would favor. So, you know, part of this is whose ox is getting gored, but you know, we should really want them to pay a lot of attention to precedent because it's meaningful.
Talking to Ryan Owens from UW-Madison, looking at a new session of the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, let's start with the case that they've already heard oral arguments on a few different workplace discrimination allegations here coming up to the court based on a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender identity. What's at stake in this case?
Well, so the first thing to note is that this is a statutory interpretation question. The question here is whether or not a federal statute which makes it illegal to discriminate on the basis of sex incorporates sexual orientation in it. So this is not a constitutional case. It is a statutory interpretation case. And that sometimes does affect how justices decide a case. They can say, for example, you know, if we get this wrong, Congress can always come in and clean up that mess later. If we interpret a statute the way they didn't want us to, they can come back and repass that statute. So that should operate in the background here as we think about this case. Now, the question is, does sexual orientation sort of naturally and reasonably fall within this definition of on the basis of sex? There are a couple of things that are unquestioned in this case. And the first is that when Congress passed this statute in the 1960s, there is no doubt whatsoever that they did not intend for this to be considered. Right. No question about it. In fact, medical dictionaries called homosexuality, you know, a medical disease at the time. So there's it's undoubted that Congress did not have this in mind. Now, the question is, can the text be interpreted broadly enough to include sexual orientation in here? And this is why I brought up the whole statutory interpretation question, because I don't think it's an altogether implausible view for somebody to argue that sexual orientation could be considered in there. There's an argument to be made there. It may or may not be a strong argument, depending on your perspective. But I do think that the court looks at this and says, hey, this is going to be a sea change in the law. If we include sexual orientation within this, that is a pretty monumental decision, and maybe we're not the ones that ought to be making these kinds of huge decisions. And I think they'll look at things like Congress recently passing Sexual Orientation Equality Act, at least the House did, and that's evidence to suggest that members of Congress don't think that this sexual orientation folds within on the basis of sex. And you also see a number of states over the last decade or so passing a lot of statutes that ban sexual orientation discrimination. If it's the case that you can just fold that right in with on the basis of sex, it would render all of those statutes or attempted statutes superfluous. So I think the justices are very cautious about pushing out on this boundary, particularly when there's been so much activity in the legislatures on it. I would not be surprised to see the justices say in this case, it's a bridge too far for us to go, but you know we'll see what happens.
And people have been paying attention to Justice Gorsuch on this one, and with this kind of how you interpret statute laws passed by Congress, there's two different schools of thought. One is we need to look at the intent of the lawmakers at the time. I'm oversimplifying, I'm sure. And one is no, look at the letters, look at the words that they wrote. And Gorsuch's view to somebody says, look at the words, and people looked at what happened in the oral argument and thought, he could be a swing vote in a surprising way. What do you think of that?
Well, just one quick point is there are actually three schools of thought on this. One is to look at the intent. One is to look at the text, and particularly what the framers of the text meant when they passed it. And the third is just to look at the text today and kind of think whatever you think it means today, right? And that's sort of what's called the living constitution approach to things. The textualists in this case, it's unclear. There's not a particularly strong case to be made one way or the other on this. I think in this case, whether you're a textualist, whether you believe in intent, or whether you're just a living constitutionalist, it's going to come down to what the justices are most comfortable with. And I know that sounds a little strange when we're talking about lawyers and judges, but I think that's ultimately where it comes down. I think you're going to have a number of justices say, how we feel about this issue is irrelevant. What's important here is the institutional question. Which institution is better off deciding this case? And, you know, on that score, I do think that you're going to have probably five votes lined up to say, let's let Congress take care of this.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that Congress could, if you could get agreement on it from both chambers and both parties, in effect, sometimes a tall order, they could nail this down. Yeah, when we say on the basis of sex, we include sexual orientation, for example.
That's right. And I think the question there is, should the courts look at congressional will on this issue? I think the answer to that is no. We're talking about institutional prerogatives here. And if this is something that's best left to the legislature, I don't think they look at that secondary question of whether this particular legislature is defunct.
Talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's new term with Ryan Owens, political science professor, director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership at UW-Madison. Talking about a lot of the different cases on the Supreme Court docket. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this case we were just talking about? Should employers be allowed to fire, gay or lesbian workers over their sexual preference? Should the court be the decider on this issue in defining how civil rights protections work? Do you have more general questions or thoughts on the makeup of the Supreme Court and the future and the kinds of decisions they make? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look at the U.S. Supreme Court's new term. They're hearing cases about workplace discrimination, abortion, guns, immigration, a lot of hot-button issues. Ryan Owens is our guest, political science professor and director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Which case do you most care about? Which issue are you most concerned about as it goes before the U.S. Supreme Court? Do you have a question about the makeup of the court and the way people might vote? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A couple listeners commented on the case on workplace discrimination and LGBT issues. Krista says, as long as the person's doing the work, what difference does their sexual preference make? And Scott says, I think it should be left up to employee and employer as to whether they want to enter into a business transaction without governmental interference. You could join in with your thoughts again on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's move on to some of the other issues coming up. I don't think we're going to get to all of them because there's a lot. But an abortion case, this one coming, I think, from Louisiana on admitting privileges in abortion clinics. Texas had done something like this. The Supreme Court a few years back struck down their version of law, pretty similar law from Louisiana. What's going on here?
Yeah, it's not altogether clear what's going on here, frankly. So as you mentioned, the Louisiana law is very similar to the Texas law that the Supreme Court struck by 5-3 a couple of years ago. So this was Scalia was out. He had passed away. And Justice Kennedy sided with the liberals in that case to strike down the Texas statute. It's unclear what exactly is going on here. I mean, we do know one thing. It looks like Louisiana said, now is the time for us. Right? We're going to try to push this as far as we can because it looks like the timing is right. So they pushed this case forward. In the meantime, Chief Justice Roberts here did vote with the liberals to put a stay on that statute while the court prepares to hear this case. So, what's going on there? My guess is he put that stay on it because Louisiana sort of, it was an affront, I think, to the court and the court's decision. So, where are people going to come out in this case? I don't know. Frankly, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, the court could summarily reverse this lower court decision, not even, give us an extensive opinion. Just say, this is so much like this previous case out of Texas that we're just going to reverse you summarily. I'm not sure that that's going to happen, but I am not convinced that the court is going to use this case as one to substantially redefine abortion doctrine. It just seems unusual. It just doesn't feel right to me. It's so quickly after the other one.
Right. So the only circumstance that really has changed here is we have a different justice who might vote the other way. Is that kind of how people are looking at this?
Yeah. I mean, we don't know. I mean, we don't have a whole lot of history with Justice Kavanaugh on abortion. So I think people are just trying to see what's going to happen. I mean, this is one of these, canary in the mine cases and see where it can go. Frankly, I would be surprised if the court uses this as the case where it really is going to cut back to the extent that it decides it wants to cut back on abortion rights anytime in the next few years.
On the precedent question, a lot of people are looking at Justice Roberts in cases like these thinking, okay, maybe he would in normal circumstances vote on one side, but he's looking at it saying, hey, you took this to my court a few years back. I'm not gonna flip that precedent that my court just did a few years ago.
Yeah, he is the most institutionalist of the justices, if I can say that. And not surprisingly, he's the chief. Historically, this is going to fall on his shoulders. So I think that's right. And just, put yourself in Roberts' position here for a second. The court is, getting attacked by both sides right now. He's trying to stay above the fray. He's trying to protect the legacy and the institutional support that the court has. And now he may be dragged into impeachment proceedings as well. He will have to preside over any Senate impeachment inquiry hearing in which, the president is involved. So, you could have a circumstance where Roberts has to go in the afternoon on one day and preside over this trial, and the next day hear a case that involves the president. This has to be weighing on him a little bit, and I think he will take into consideration some of these extra legal considerations.
This is an issue that could come before the court. It's not there yet, but Congress wants stuff from the executive branch. The executive branch doesn't want to give them that stuff. Ultimately, yeah. This could go really quickly, potentially, to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we saw that with the Nixon impeachment. The court rendered a decision in that case that in a criminal proceeding, the president's ability to use executive privilege as a shield is not unqualified, that in a criminal proceeding, courts have access to these materials for a host of reasons. It could be a similar case that comes before the Supreme Court now over this matter. We'll have to see.
In the public eye, we have Democratic and Republican Supreme Court justices. I'm sure a Supreme Court justice would slap you for saying that, but but that's the view. Is it that simple if a case like a contest between House Democrats and a Republican president comes to the Supreme Court?
No, it's not that simple at all. And I would get slapped if I made that argument. What we have here are judicial philosophies. And I think it is safe to say that there tends to be a correlation between ideological proclivities and certain judicial philosophies. But it is the philosophy that drives the outcome for these justices and not partisanship. And frankly, look, I've said this before, too. Donald Trump is no conservative, right? He is by no means a conservative as classically defined. So most of these justices are well-trained in conservative and liberal political thought. They know what it means to be a conservative or a liberal philosophically. And so, even if there are partisan affiliations with members of Congress and the president, those same affiliations do not exist with nominees to the high court and the president.
Do we have a lot of precedent in recent years with most of these justices when it comes to balance of power issues between the White House, whoever's in it, and Congress, whoever's running it?
We've had some decisions. Honestly, the real indicator would have been a couple of terms ago with the DACA case. Now, we've got a case this term where we're going to reevaluate portions of that. But if ever there was a case in which you would have established somebody's bona fides in terms of the separation of powers, it would have been that one. I think there is a very, very legitimate case to be made that the president's use of DACA and DAPA, President Obama, was incredibly unconstitutional, if I can put an adverb before that. It was a power grab by the executive branch that I think was unheralded and unconstitutional. It would have been interesting to see what the liberal justices did. And so often we look at the conservative and say, well, when are they going to break with the president? We can't forget that there are four liberals who are fairly doctrinaire on this court as well. And it would have been interesting to see how they would have operated in that case, whether they would have voted against Obama or not, just as it'll be interesting in this term to see what happens with the conservative justices and Trump in this immigration case.
Well, let's stay with the deferred action for childhood arrivals. President Trump tweeted yesterday that he wants the court to strike it down. I'll quote here, if the Supreme Court upholds DACA, it gives the president extraordinary powers far greater than ever thought. They do what is right and not let it stand with all its negative legal implications. Republicans and Democrats will have a deal to let them stay in our country in very short order. So the president arguing against presidential powers in a way.
Yeah, well, that's rich. Given the emergency, action that he wanted to take at the border, I mean, I think that was just as excessive as Obama's unconstitutional actions were. But yeah, we will see what happens in this case. He is trying to use his authority, his discretionary authority, to wind down an existing existing DACA and DAPA cases. The key here, of course, is that their stated rationale, at least first, for revoking this or winding it down was that they thought it was illegal and unconstitutional. And what the challenger said was that's a legal question, and it's up to courts to make that determination. And if you do that as your sole decision, you're actually not exercising a policy decision. You're exercising a legal one. So we don't have to defer to your policy judgment on this matter. Ultimately, I'm not sure how much it's going to matter. There are policy and legal interpretations sort of wound up in this decision. My guess would be that the court says this is more of a policy decision that the president has the authority to undo.
Looking at a new session of the U.S. Supreme Court with Ryan Owens from UW-Madison. I want to give a listen to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, asked by NPR during an event in New York recently why she didn't retire when Barack Obama was still president. She says she's been asked that a lot. Here's a listen to some of what she had to say.
When that suggestion is made, I ask the questioner, who do you think that the president could nominate that could get through the Republican Senate that you would prefer to have on the court than me?
So Justice Ginsburg, a lot of eyes on her. She's 86, just finished radiation treatment for a tumor on her pancreas. One of the more gruesome parts of observing the Supreme Court is looking at older court members. Talk about her significance on the court.
Yeah, well, honestly, there's a lot of hubris, I think, in that comment. It's not up to her to decide what the Republican Senate would approve of or not approve of. The question is are you fit to remain in that office? Should you retire? And I think, you know, I think we as citizens should be very, very skeptical of people who think that they can serve in that capacity until death takes them. There should be a little bit more regular rotation in that position. Now, you know, given her situation on the bench right now, yeah, I don't think there's any chance that she's voluntarily going to leave this court, certainly not with this president. But, you know, if she does pass away or something happens and she has to leave the court, all hell is going to break loose. You think it's polarized right now. Just imagine what happens if we have impeachment and then a vacancy on the court.
Just 30 seconds, you see, we say we need more rotation. Do we need something like a term limit system on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, I wouldn't be opposed to a term limit system. I think the court packing plans that are being offered are silly and stupid. But I do think that rotation in office from a term limit is not a bad idea. As long as it's lengthy enough that you can ensure judicial independence, then I think it's something to look into.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Ryan Owens, political science professor and director of the Tommy G. Thompson Center on Public Leadership at UW-Madison. We previewed the U.S. Supreme Court's new term. Among the issues at play, abortion, gay rights, guns, immigration, presidential power, and separation of church and state. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, recent lawsuits against media organizations have raised concerns about the future of First Amendment protections for the press. We'll hear about some of the latest news, and you can share your thoughts. Electric cars have been on the streets for quite a while now, and the electric pickup business got a boost with a huge order from Amazon. An auto industry expert gives us the latest on the future of electric vehicles. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. America's Test Kitchen is back with us. This time, side dishes take center stage. We'll get some first-rate sides that won't play second fiddle on the table. That and look at some of the top news stories from around Wisconsin. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, Kate talks to the author of a new book about Vice President Mike Pence, his career, his run for the nation's second highest office, and his role now in the White House. That's tomorrow at 7 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a new bill being considered in the state legislature would fund full-day kindergarten for four-year-olds. We'll talk to one of the bill's co-sponsors and to an early childhood education expert about the impact that legislation could have. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.